All right. We'll try to finish up the discussion of the state and politics today. Got two parts to our agenda. First half, we'll be finishing lecture 21 on the state and accumulation, basically the relationship between the state and the capitalist economy and how to think about the contradictory character of that interconnection. And the second half, after the break, will be on the logic of the democratic aspect of the state, which is basically about the relationship between the state and the working class. So to kind of simplify the story a bit, today is about the relationship between the state and capital in the first half, and the second is the state and the working class. Democracy is a solution to navigating the complex relationship between the state and subordinate classes. How can that relationship be institutionalized in a stable way? And the first part of today's session is on how to manage the relationship between the state and the capitalist economy. Just to remind you where we are in this saga, the starting point last time was to repeat the essential insight of the functionalist account of the state that's embedded in the Marxist tradition. Many Marxists deny that their argument is at its core, that the theoretical logic of the argument about the state is at its core functionalist, but I think it is in the Marxist tradition. That's the base superstructure metaphor is all about how superstructures are functional for the base. Sometimes the language that's used is reproduce rather than functional for, but it's essentially the same problem. A functional description of that sort becomes a functional explanation when, in addition to saying, yes, the state serves these functions to reproduce capitalism in various ways, one also uses that as part of the explanation for why the state is the way it is. And I think that is both the dominant current within the Marxist tradition, and I think it's basically okay. You know, I'm not an anti-functionalist in this respect. I don't think, however, that smooth functionalism, a kind of automatic, self-adjusting, homeostatic view of functionalism is even remotely plausible. And what we need is this much more uncomfortable, complex idea of the state as having a contested and contradictory functionality. And that's contradictory functionality is a kind of, it's almost an oxymoron. You know, if it's functional, how can it be contradictory? Well, that's part of the complexity here. It's a little bit of a provocation, of course, to say contradictory functionality. But I think that's still how we should grapple with this kind of complexity. Not reject the functional logic, because indeed it is the case that capitalism would destroy itself quickly if in the absence of a set of regulatory institutions that steered it and corrected and contained the conflicts and disruptive potentials of capitalism. Yet the institutions created to do so can never do so fully successfully. So they are both containing problems and contributing to problems. And that's why it's messy and not a smoothly functioning organism. Well, that's the kind of setup for the story, for this account. The first face of this contradictory, contested, contingent functionality was the problem of the relationship between two different functions of the state and how they may not fit together. So it would be one thing if the state only had to do one thing, but it has to do many things. And in particular, it has to do things that render it legitimate to the masses of the population, let's to simplify, say, to the subordinate classes. And it has to do things that reproduce and facilitate accumulation in the interests of the dominant classes. So it has to do these two things. Those are referred to as a shorthand as the legitimation function and the accumulation function. Sometimes those go happily together. And when they do, everything looks like it is kind of a well-functioning, well-ordered, integrated system. But often it happens, or at least periodically it happens, that these two functions are at odds with each other. That what's needed to strengthen the conditions of accumulation undermines the conditions for legitimation. What's needed to consolidate legitimation undermines the conditions of accumulation. You can't do both optimally. And then the balance between what you do depends upon political struggles, historical contingencies, institutional rigidities. Which of these two functional requirements is most easily adjusted? I don't think the view should be that whenever there is a conflict between legitimation and accumulation, accumulation wins out. That's too simple. I mean, in the long run, of course, it's true that as long as the system remains capitalist, some degree of support for accumulation is going to be needed. And so in some sense or other, one might say accumulation will win out whenever there's a conflict between these two functions. But more often than not, it's a muddled combination of the two. And in a way, that's what we're seeing today. You know, as I mentioned, in spite of the kind of maniacal hysteria of the right wing of the Republican Party, the basic legitimation functions of the state have not been dismantled. The social wage in the U.S. is weaker than it is in Europe, but it's a hell of a lot more than it was 100 years ago. And the prospect of it being ratcheted back to the 1890s is very, very slim. You know, I just don't see it happening. Even, you know, take the worst case scenarios. Rick Perry gets elected president and we have 60 Republican senators and a substantial majority in the House. Even under that bleak scenario, the consequence of that is not going to be a 20% flat tax and a full privatization of Social Security, so that Social Security pensions are entirely in the stock, you know, in private mutual funds, an elimination of Medicare, and an elimination of Medicaid, et cetera, and an end to publicly supported unemployment insurance. That's not going to be the consequence of even the worst case scenario. And that's because these legitimation functions, the things that provide a social wage to reduce the sense of perpetual anxiety and precariousness in a capitalist society, are essential for the well-functioning of capitalism. You know, to have, in a developed capitalist country, the mass of the population constantly on the verge of destitution because of the precariousness and no safety net and no future would be enormously destabilizing. And I think the worst case scenario still would not mean that the legitimation function is completely abandoned in favor of creating a kind of free market accumulation regime. This is aside from the fact that the accumulation policies of that wing of the Republican Party, which is now the Republican Party, would be disastrous for accumulation itself. You can't have a stable system of capital accumulation without public goods that are essential for capital itself. Okay. That's the first point. The first example, the first of these four types of contradictions were between two distinct functions. The second source of problematic functionality is a contradiction within the accumulation function itself. This is the argument that Offey makes some of the readings that were assigned today. It's complex. The Offey readings, I think, are hard. For those of you who have grappled with them, you know, it's pretty clear. But it's still, this is more difficult reading than, I think he's harder to read than Terborn, for example. Terborn is a little bit more straightforward. But I think it's a really interesting and important kind of argument. And it's actually an argument that's pretty much at the center of the political debates today about the problem of the state. When Ronald Reagan coined the expression, the state is not the solution to the problems, it is the problem, what he is arguing for is the Frankenstein problem. What he's identifying is the Frankenstein problem. in effect, I think. That's at least one way of doing it. And that's, if you want a, you know, it's nice to have these little slogans that help you anchor different theoretical points. The Offey argument about the contradictions within the accumulation function, you can think of as the Frankenstein problem. So the Frankenstein story, of course, is the mad scientist, Dr. Frankenstein, creates a monster, which in the end he can't control. The monster, you know, ends up being out of control and wreaks havoc. And that's the that's why the metaphor is relevant here. In order to solve the problems that capitalism faces in its own internal operation. So these are not the problems caused by working class struggles, by resistance to capitalism and the need to contain class struggle. These are problems endogenous to the very process of accumulation. In order to solve those problems, in the interests of stable accumulation, you have to create an apparatus, we call it the state, capable of intervening in the capitalist economy. Because you can't solve these problems if you create a state that only does the night watchman duties, if the only thing the state does is protect private property. So the minimalist function of the state is, in capitalism, is that it enforces property rights. The enforcement of property rights brings with it the control of class struggle, because a lot of class struggles are challenges to property rights. So if that's all the state did, it would not, in fact, create the necessary conditions for stable capital accumulation. To solve those problems, the state has to do more than that. The state must, so that's the first thesis. The state must intervene to prevent capitalism from destroying itself economically, from destroying its own conditions of existence in economic terms. So this, the state has to intervene, for example, to prevent negative externalities from overwhelming the system. The state has to intervene to regulate the money supply, to avoid hyperinflation, or to avoid financial collapses. If the state has a hands-off, if you have a free market in the minting of money, you know, that's one of the proposals. Ron Paul's proposal is to get rid of public currencies and to let any bank issue currencies and just have a competition among currencies. You know, it's just to have the markets handle this. Well, that would be completely self-destructive for the smooth functioning of a capitalist economy, because it would destroy the predictability and the confidence level necessary for people to take current resources and invest them for future gains. If there's no confidence in the stable character of the metric by which you measure the value of your investments, the state must intervene. In order to do so, however, the state needs autonomy. Now, what does that mean? The state needs autonomy. It means that the decisions that the state makes as to how to intervene, when to intervene, and what form to intervene cannot simply be dictated by capitalists. Now, that's actually a pretty complicated claim and shouldn't be just taken as axiomatic. The idea here is this. If it were the case that the human beings that are capitalists, that is the actual bearers of these relations, the people who occupy those positions in the class structure, if it happened to be the case that they were all far-sighted, concerned about the welfare of the fellow members of their class, concerned about the long-term stability of capitalism, and not just about their wealth, their firms, their security, if they were these, you know, fully class-conscious actors willing to make individual sacrifices for the collective welfare of capitalism, if that were true, if it was imaginable that capitalism could produce a class of capitalists with that kind of consciousness, then they could simply dictate to the state what to do. The state wouldn't need any autonomy. The state would need no autonomy if it were the case that capitalists had that kind of class consciousness. Now, capitalists are very class conscious in a narrower sense. You know, they're very conscious about who their enemies are, about, you know, which social forces they want to marginalize, about who their friends are. You know, they're conscious of class in that sense. But they no more have this kind of consciousness, the kind of consciousness that would enable them to simply pull the strings and manipulate the state in a way that would actually solve the problems of accumulation. They're no more conscious spontaneously in that way than workers are spontaneously conscious about their collective interests as a collectivity against capital and their need to be solidaristic and to make individual sacrifices for purposes of collective power. So the problem, the reason why autonomy is necessary is that if capitalists as persons manipulated the state, they would do so in ways that advantage them. They would use it as, to use in the language of economists, they would use it as an opportunity for rent seeking. That is, to use the levers of state power to personally, in terms of their interests, escape from the pressures of competition, to insulate their own firms and their own wealth from threat from other capitalists and from the world market and so on. And they would, in the end, be colonizing the state for particularistic interests rather than using the state to create robust conditions of accumulation. Now, of course, it's a little more complicated even than that. Some capitalists would be far-sighted. There are always in the capitalist class some powerful, wealthy corporate actors that do embrace the big picture, that do understand what's needed to sustain accumulation. And then there's a lot of myopic, self-seeking rent seekers who just don't give a shit about the system as a whole. They just care about their own well-being. Yeah.
So when you take like the world system, you look at peripheral nations and you look at the way that multinational firms move in. I mean, so would you say there's a degree of autonomy that perhaps like developing states, you know, like nations in the core, the state has more autonomy than those in the developing world, for instance, which rely on multinational firms to come in, and to refuse such would be to refuse development in their, you know.
Well, autonomy is not autonomy from global, it's not autonomy from capitalist dynamics. It's autonomy from manipulation by capitalist persons.
Okay.
That is, this is institutional autonomy from the manipulation by powerful actors outside of the state. All that the state autonomy means is that the actors inside the state have room to maneuver, to make decisions about what's best for whatever they're trying to accomplish, the stability of their economies, the welfare of their citizens, whatever they care about, they make those decisions through their own deliberations and their own expertise, subject to all sorts of constraints, but not the dictates of outside actors. So it's remember the quip in the initial discussion of the distinction between the state in capitalist society versus the capitalist state. The state acts on behalf of capital, but not at the behest of capitalists. That is, it's not, the state doesn't engage in pro-accumulation policies because Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and the Koch brothers get on the phone and say to the state, the key actors, do this. The key actors do this because they look at the capitalist economy and in their best judgment, this is what needs to be done in order to make a robust environment for accumulation. Now, that's all that autonomy means. Autonomy doesn't mean that they're autonomous to act against the needs of accumulation. It's that they're autonomous to act against the demands of capitalists, but not the needs of accumulation. Now, they can act against the needs of accumulation, but that sets in motion a set of consequences which makes it harder and harder for them to continue acting against accumulation until they correct the mistake. That's why there is a functional logic here. The functional logic, just to repeat this part of the story, is state can make all sorts of mistakes. It can even deliberately act against accumulation. But if it does so, it faces consequences, not of its choosing. And those consequences come back to force changes. If you engage in policies that create disastrous disruptions to accumulation, You are forced eventually to try to correct those mistakes. And the kind of experimentalist iterative process continues until you get some kind of new equilibrium. But the second thesis, this is thesis two, is that the state needs autonomy in order to act functionally. Now, autonomy is a variable. It's not a dichotomy. It's not the state is or is not autonomous. The state is always in some ways autonomous and in some ways not. There are particular ways and particular times in which state policies do get just dictated by special interests that capture particular agencies. There are contrasts between countries in the extent to which state agencies that are involved in accumulation act autonomously, actually have this capacity for real planning and for careful, fine-tuned interventions, and countries and agencies at times and places that are just captured by special interests. There are moments where certain parts of the state are thought of as the franchise state, you know, the particular industry groups and interests simply dictate what the policy are, what the policy might be. In the United States, energy policy has been particularly vulnerable to capture. So the energy policies of the United States are not in the long-term interests of capital accumulation by American capitalism. These are not the optimal policies. They're policies heavily weighted to a particular form of energy production, and the explanation for this is not that this is functional for capitalism, it's that this is good for oil, the oil sector. It's good for the oil sector. Why? Why are the policies this way? It's because they're powerful and they've dictated. That is at the behest of that sector, not on the behalf of capitalism. So there's non-autonomy operating all the time along with autonomy. The key idea that Offie wants to project here, and it's a perspective that's informed by the European experience, where the state has acted more autonomously in many contexts than in the American context, but it applies to the U.S. as well, that the state needs this autonomy in order to be functional for the long-run management of the capitalist economy, for crisis management, for steering the capitalist economy effectively. It needs autonomy. But this autonomy poses the Frankenstein problem. In order for the state to intervene functionally, it has to have the capacity to do so destructively. There's no way of giving it just the amount of autonomy needed to be functional without that also giving it power to do damage, to act dysfunctionally. And that's the problem. You know, you want a state autonomous enough to do the right thing, but to give it that amount of autonomy, it also can do the wrong thing. And there's really no institutional solution to that problem. That's why it's unstable, why you get cycles. You know, state gets more autonomy, it does things that are good for accumulation, begins to overstep those bounds with respect to at least the perceptions of some sectors of capital. And then there's a counter movement by conservative political forces to dismantle the autonomy of the state, to put it back into wraps, to basically to undermine its capacity to act. The reason why building up state capacity, there's two connected ideas here that sometimes get collapsed. There's building up the capacity of the state to intervene. Does it have the bureaucratic and administrative means to actually go out and do things? So you can pass a law saying, for example, that all meat has to be inspected to be free of E. coli. So we have had in the U.S. on the books the federal government regulating the and certifying the quality of our food stuff since the early 20th century, right? That in the progressive era, those laws were initially passed. But then you can gut the FDA, federal, what is it? Drug Administration, right? And reduce the number of inspectors to so few that they're simply incapable. They no longer have the administrative capacity to actually do the testing. You can dismantle the labs which do the testing so that the backlog in labs is sufficiently long that the testing becomes ineffective. You can do all sorts of things to undermine the capacity. That's one thing that can happen. Or you could keep all the capacity, but then have the administrators and the board of advisors be all appointed by the food industry. So they have the capacity to regulate, but they just don't use the capacity to regulate in the interests of consumers because they're captured. Capacity refers to your ability to intervene, and autonomy refers to your willingness to intervene in a public way, in the interests of the system as a whole, or in the interests of the public. So there's both an issue of autonomy, are agencies captured, and capacity, do they have the ability to do some things. The Frankenstein problem can be solved by eliminating the capacity to do things. So you still have the monster, it still has its autonomous brain, but you've hobbled it, you know, you've put it in shackles, you've reduced its capacity to do damage. So the Frankenstein problem comes from this combination of giving the machinery a capacity to intervene and giving it an autonomy in the use of that capacity. The punchline of the thesis 3 is that there really is no stable equilibrium. There's no stable equilibrium. Every solution will have its will accumulate problems, and therefore there will be changes. So we're in a period now where there's this right-wing assault on the capacity of the state to do things. I would be prepared to make a very strong prediction that this will not go on for 10 years. Right? So by the year 2021, you know, 10 years from now, we will be in some other cycle on this, that this episode of continual assault on the capacity of the state to regulate the economy in a way that makes for a healthy capitalism will blow itself out. How long it'll take for them to blow themselves out of the water will depend upon contingent political questions. So things like the recall of Walker matter, because that's the sort of thing that can affect the time duration for the counter movement that's going on right now, and can then shorten the time horizon before the rebuilding of state capacity can start. There's a third element. This is under 2.3. I've listed problems. The first is that once the capacity is created, then it is a target for manipulation by interests. The second problem is extending the interventionist capacity leads to this constant problem of the line of demarcation between the state and economy, and there's no stable solution to that. There's a third problem, which Offie doesn't emphasize as much, I think, as I didn't reread the article, but this is my recollection. He mentions this, but I don't think it's at the center. And that's this, that as you increase the capacity of the state to intervene and its autonomy, to intervene in benign ways for capitalism, in ways that are good for capitalism, this calls into question it begins to interact with the normative system and calls into question the appropriate boundaries for what the state should do. A state that has lots of capacity and lots of autonomy is an attractive target, object for popular struggles to get the state involved in projects and programs that have nothing to do with capital accumulation, that have a lot to do with creating the conditions for sustainable, desirable, high quality of life for ordinary people. The estate that has no capacities or limited capacities, that's acting in a minimalist way, that may be bad for capitalism, but also it makes it unattractive for popular forces, because it's not a state that's going to be able to accomplish anything for popular purposes. This can be thought of as the problem of the interaction of the state with the normative system. So as it increases its capacity for intervention for purposes of accumulation, it's harder to restrict its availability for these legitimation functions. So what capitalists would really like would be to increase the capacity of the state to do all that's needed to create robust accumulation without making that state also available for popular purposes, which would be these legitimation purposes. But when you expand the state capacity, you open up a space for that politicization of popular demands and popular needs. They become more directed toward the state rather than just either diffused or directed towards self-help kinds of projects. It's notable in the current period, as people's cynicism about the state and their belief that the state can't do anything has increased, there's more emphasis in popular movements towards self-help kinds of solutions to problems. Now that has some positive aspects to it. Everything is contradictory and complicated. I think there's some very positive aspects to the fact that in a devastated city like Detroit, that a lot of energy is going towards things like developing neighborhood-based urban agriculture projects, as Nate can attest to. That there's these efforts to create interstitial bottom-up solutions. But partially that reflects a belief now that the state isn't going to come to the rescue, that you can't make demands on the state of Michigan, certainly not on the city of Detroit, which is bankrupt. You can't make demands on the state of Michigan. They're just not going to be met. There's no political space for that. Demands on the state of Michigan to provide development and infrastructure building and incubators and all the things that would be needed to revitalize the local economy. So there is this sort of grassroots sense, okay, either we just wallow in our despair or we get on with the business of trying to build an alternative and to solve our problems to the best that we can. Well, there is a positive aspect to that. I think that from the point of view of a kind of counter-hegemonic long-term view of what it will take to go beyond the constraints of capitalism, building new institutions from below is part of what needs to be done. But it's also a highly constrained process because of the severe lack of resources that are available if all you can rely on is the time and energy of people from below and you don't have any ability to tax and to capture part of the social surplus for purposes of counter-institutional development. So we're in a period where that's the central response because the state capacities have been destroyed. Well, that's part of this Frankenstein problem. If you have all that state capacity, if you have a state that has all this ability to do things, that has a high tax capacity so it has lots of revenues, then the citizens of Detroit in the context of the devastation would say, well, what we really need to do is to mobilize to get the state to provide resources to help us solve these problems rather than just do it on bootstrapping it on our own. The conclusion then of this part of the analysis is, I think, can be summarized in three sort of mega theses. This is under 2.4. The first is the functionalism thesis. The state is functionally required to overcome the self-destructive tendencies of capitalism. Libertarians deny this. They're wrong. This isn't a question of one's perspective. This is, I think, a scientific truth about capitalism. The state is functionally required by capitalism to overcome the self-destructive tendencies of capitalism. The Frankenstein thesis, then, says, to fulfill these functions, the state must have the capacity to potentially act dysfunctionally. It has to have real autonomy of policy formation and action. And it'll act dysfunctionally for the reasons that it'll have that potential for the reasons laid out. And the contradiction thesis is that various dynamics are set in motion, which makes it increasingly probable that the state will act dysfunctionally over time. That is, if you create this capacity, there will be dynamic tendencies for these dysfunctions to build up over time. And this creates what Offie calls a crisis of crisis management. A crisis of crisis management. We are now in a period of a crisis of crisis management. Capitalism needs crisis management. The mechanisms of crisis management are themselves in crisis. And after some period of time, one would expect, there'll be some resolution of the crisis of crisis management through a new project of institution building and increase of state capacity. But how traumatic the transition from the current crisis of crisis management is to the reconstruction of a crisis management capacity, how long and protracted and how much suffering takes place in the course of that process, that of course is historically contingent. It depends upon political forces and other matters. All right, that's the second face of contradictory functionality. Questions, issues? I'm sure we're racing through this material in order to catch up on our schedule, but that should not preempt your puzzlements taking the form of questions. Yeah?
I'm just kind of curious as to how different units of analysis of the state, right? So you talk about the state of Michigan, right, which is at a different than the state, but so like you have, how does it articulate like a regional state with a bureaucracy when its interests sometimes contradict the federal state, right, at the highest level? There's an articulation that seems different. I just don't know how to conceptualize that.
So I think the way to think about this is that different units in any complex system that isn't fully centralized. So there are examples of states that are close to fully centralized in the sense there's only one rule setting and surplus extracting political unit. So states, there's these two aspects of the state. They set rules, the laws that regulate things, and they extract part of the surplus. Taxation is the term we use for extracting surplus. It's the main way it happens. This is a point I didn't make when we briefly talked about taxation in the context of Terrebonne. I like to think of taxation as not merely a redistribution of the surplus. So that's part of it. Surplus gets produced by capitalism, and part of it gets redistributed to the state through taxation. That's one way of thinking of it, and it's partially true. But taxation is also a mechanism for creating surplus in the following sense. The boundary between what is, how big the surplus is and how much is in what's the non-surplus. You have a total product, total income, and you divide it between surplus and the rest, right? That boundary is not fixed. The boundary isn't fixed. That's what the whole idea of the rate of exploitation is, right? The rate of exploitation is how much of the total value produced gets captured as the surplus and how much goes to simply reproduce the conditions of production and the standards of living. Well, when you think about it, how much it goes into the non-surplus is a function of, in part, people's willingness to pay taxes. So the working class's willingness to pay taxes, when do they, in fact, resist paying taxes politically or by cheating, if to the extent they can, that will determine how much of the total social product they retain for their standard of living and how much is available for collective purposes. One of the reasons why Sweden has such a high level of taxation, 45% of GDP, is the willingness of workers to shift their consumption from private consumption to the social wage. The social wage is paid for out of surplus through taxes. That's a decision to lower their private standard of living, in effect. That is lowered in the sense of how much of their standard of living depends upon the income which they personally control versus how much of their standard of living is determined by the income controlled collectively through the social wage. So taxation affects the allocation between surplus and non-surplus as well as the distribution of the surplus between private investment and public use. Taxation is operating on both of those levels. Okay, so states, this is a roundabout answer to the question about Michigan, so to speak. Wisconsin. All levels of state have the capacity to tap into the surplus and extract surplus because they have tax capacities, and to set rules. Now, the jurisdictional issue of what rules can be set by what levels of state, that varies enormously. The United States is relatively extreme on the spectrum of countries in the amount of sovereign powers it assigns to what we call states. And within the United States, it's also relatively extreme compared to many countries in how much power it accords to municipal governments. That is, municipal governments in the United States traditionally have been able to set tax rates. In most countries, city governments cannot set tax rates on the things which they can tax. You know, most countries, you could not have a city sales tax that's different from the sales tax of a larger jurisdiction. In the United States, in some states you can do that, in some states not. So we assign significant autonomous powers pretty far down, and in a tiered kind of way. And part of why we have conflicts around states' rights and municipal autonomy is precisely because of the ambiguities of some of these jurisdictional things. Now, you asked the question about the contradictions between the national level state and the state level state. One would want to distinguish between political conflicts, between the political balance of power at the national level and at the state level, versus contradictions in the structure between national regulation and state regulation. So these are distinct issues. In the United States, we have as a special kind of conflict, which most places don't have, most countries don't have, the fact that there's competition between states in creating tax subsidies for businesses. So we have what's sometimes called the race to the bottom around taxation because of the desire to attract investment. So you'll have Tennessee bidding against Michigan for the building of a new Mercedes-Benz, or I guess it was Alabama, right? Alabama against the Rust Belt for the building of a new Mercedes-Benz factory. And the competition takes the form of tax subsidies between these different jurisdictions. That is a problem that gets set up because of this tax autonomy at the lower level. That would not be an issue if we had unified taxation in the United States. But then there's also contradictions when you have a liberal state and a conservative federal government, or vice versa, in terms of what the political priorities are. I think of that as a political conflict rather than a political economic contradiction. The biggest political economic contradiction that we've had in American history was around the North-South divide. There the question was that the local state in the South was connected to a very different kind of class structure from the North. So you really did have a different set of functional requirements. The functional requirements imposed on the local state in the South were very different from the functional requirements on the rest of the country because of slavery before the Civil War and because of segregation and sharecropping throughout much of the first part of the 20th century. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Let's quickly go through the last two of these contradictions. So the first one was legitimation versus accumulation. The second one is the Frankenstein problem, contradictions interior to accumulation. The third cluster of contradictions revolve around a contradiction between the form of the state, its bureaucratic and administrative structures, or what Offey, I think, refers to as the administrative rationality of the state, contradictions internal to that relative to what the state is called upon to do. So the state is called upon, in order to serve the interests of accumulation, to make the capitalist economy work well, the state has to do certain things. It has an administrative structure which enables it to do certain things. What Offey argues is that there is a contradiction between the kind of rationality the state needs to do and the kind of administrative structures which have been built up in the state. Different kinds of problems require different sorts of decision-making mechanisms in order for rational strategies to be devised. That's the key insight. Different kinds of problems require different sorts of decision-making mechanisms in order for the policies that come out of those decisions to be rational. What he argues then is that there are basically three alternative logics of decision making. So this is the menu. This is what's available. If you ask the question, how do we create the rules for environmental protection, for endangered species, for energy subsidies, the policies that will determine what are the procedures that will determine what these policies are inside of the administrative structures. What Offey argues is there's basically three ways in which decisions can be made. He pretty much wants to treat this as the menu. These are the alternatives. Each of these is rational for certain kinds of problems, but will produce suboptimal policies under other kinds of problems. The first is bureaucratic procedure. This is the rational legal application of fixed rules. This is the Weberian kind of rationality, bureaucratic rationality. You have a set of fixed rules, and what the bureaucracy is called upon to do is to carefully and systematically and non-arbitrarily implement these rules and carry out the policies that are specified by the rules. Rational legal bureaucracy is one way of making decisions in a bureaucracy. A second kind of rationality could be called technical rationality, maybe technocratic rationality, or I suppose it's technical rationality and it's what we associate with technocratic procedures. This involves bringing experts into a room together and asking them, set the rules for us on the basis of your knowledge and your expertise and the technical understanding of the problems which you have. And the third kind of rationality is rationality generated through democratic consensus building. This is the formation of interest consensus via some kind of democratic participatory process. Democracy is a way of accomplishing rationality, a way of making decisions, which then calls on people to engage in deliberation and dialogue in order to reach a full understanding of what the nature of the problem itself is. Since the actual policy may hinge more on the specification of the nature of the problem than on the technical conditions for solving the problem once specified, or on the application of fixed legal rules. So the Offey's argument is that for some kinds of issues, the application of fixed legal rules is just fine. It works perfectly well. For other things, when there's well-specified problems that are clear, you can bring in the experts and tell them, solve this for me. It gets more and more difficult when the real crux of the matter is not even understanding fully what the problem is, what problem needs to be solved. And for that, you can't just ask the experts to come in and tell us what the problem is, because there's no reason whatsoever to imagine that the experts will be able to correctly identify the problem that needs solving, since this depends upon the weighting of different values, the priorities, the trade-offs in the definition of the situation. Democratic consensus formation is particularly important where there's huge ambiguity in the nature of the problems we face. Technocratic problem solving is particularly important when there's clear problems, but they require technical solutions rather than merely the application of formal rules. And bureaucratic solutions are, and bureaucratic legal rational ones are most suitable, where you have a very stable, fixed environment in which you can then establish a set of formal rules and simply apply them to given cases. The key argument then that Offey makes in his analysis of this as a contradiction is that in the course of capitalist development, we increasingly move from a world in which bureaucratic rationality works very well to a world where technocratic rationality is called upon more and more to solve problems, but is incapable to do so because the problems are constantly changing in ways that require democratic consensus as a way of identifying problems. But democratic consensus as a way of forming problems politicizes the role of the state in a way that contradicts its accumulation function. So you can't get an administrative structure that works well and interfaces well with the nature of the problem space that it is called upon to solve. And again, this leads to a kind of messy muddling through where the decision-making logic and the functional requirements of accumulation don't fit together well. You can't just apply bureaucratic rules to solve these problems. You can't just use the technocratic solutions because they are incapable of identifying and giving adequate precision to the problems themselves. But when you invoke democratic consensus processes for this, you risk politicizing the whole process in ways that undermines this articulation of state administration and accumulation. Finally, the fourth dilemma, the fourth contradiction around functionality, which in some ways is probably the most familiar these days, because this gets invoked a lot, is the disjuncture between the functional problems, the geographical scale of the functional problems that capitalism faces, and the geographical scale of the institutions capable of solving problems. And this is basically the problem of globalization. The clearest example is probably global warming. Right? So global warming is a consequence of the negative externalities of economic growth under capitalist conditions. It's not strictly simply a consequence of capitalism. It's a consequence of capitalism under the technological conditions under which it's developed. You know, so it's certainly industrialization and the fossil fuel economy that are the immediate technological causes. Those have developed under capitalism. The role that capitalism plays in the diagnosis of the problem is the difficulty capitalism has in containing its negative externalities. So it's an inherent, deep problem of capitalism that it generates negative externalities, which, if they don't have a price that's experienced by the actors as a cost, you know, if the negative externalities are simply displaced costs, there will be incentives to increase negative externalities. Because it's basically more profitable to displace costs than it is to internalize them. That's true for producers, but it's also true for consumers. In an atomized world of consumption where each person is making their own consumption choices, if they can make consumption choices where the costs of their consumption are displaced onto others, then they can have higher consumption than they would otherwise have. If they had to pay the full costs of the externalization of these negative externalities, they would have to consume less. A nice example of this is the recent decision by the EU to impose carbon taxes on international flights into Europe. Right? So you fly into Europe from the United States, there's a certain amount of carbon put into the high atmosphere, which is more destructive than carbon at ground level, so it's especially damaging carbon emissions. That's a negative externality. So you can cost it You can figure out what's the implicit price of that negative externality, and you can add that to the ticket price so that every consumer to Europe, starting, I believe, in January, is going to have a several hundred dollar surcharge on their ticket prices. Prices are going way up in Europe next year. I don't know the date at which this kicks in. And that's going to be used for carbon offsets. Now, whether or not that's an effective remedy is another matter, but the idea, so to speak, is you plant trees, the equivalent that would absorb carbon for all the carbon you dump into the atmosphere. And if it was really done, you know, if in fact you could have carbon offsets, that would neutralize, that would be a way of neutralizing the carbon that you put into the air from an air flight. So carbon offsets cost something. You can calculate how many trees do you have to plant to cover the emissions of one flight from New York to London. And let's suppose that's $5,000 or something, cost to plant those trees. Then you tack on a $5,000 tax. And as long as you then actually plant the trees, as opposed to just treat that as revenue, that's where the ambiguity here comes. Are you going to actually plant the trees? But if you did, that would be internalizing the externality. Well, capitalism can't do that itself. The state has to do that. And that's the problem when you have a displacement of the jurisdiction of states from the jurisdiction of the problem. The problem is global for global warming. It's generated by consumers and producers all over the capitalist world. But individual states are the only regulatory capacity. Now, in principle, you could create a global commission. We've tried it in Kyoto, we tried it in Copenhagen, which would get all the states to agree to collaborate on solutions to these problems. But as we know, it's extraordinarily difficult to reach even weak consensus, and then the implementation and enforcement mechanisms are simply not present. This, therefore, is the fourth kind of contradiction in the functionality of the state. It cannot act in the functional interests of capital accumulation if the nature of the problems it has to encounter, that it would have to deal with in order to reproduce robust accumulation, are outside of its jurisdictional space. Historically, when that has happened, that's led to, at least in some context, geographical expansion of state authority. You know, so in the American experience, in the U.S., the original Articles of Confederation under which the United States was formed proved to be unsatisfactory because they did not give enough centralized authority to the national state to deal with the necessary conditions for capital accumulation under those very early capitalist forms, namely to regulate trade across state boundaries, to provide for public order, to enforce property rights. I mean, all the basic things that you want a state to do, it couldn't do under the original Articles of Confederation, and so a new constitution was written. That was an early example of something that has happened in the 20th century with the formation of the European Union. The European Union was a recognition that the individual states could no longer fully provide for the conditions for stable accumulation because of the practical economic integration on the ground of those states, and that creating some kind of authority at the supranational level would help create conditions of accumulation. They did so, however, in an incomplete way, and the current crisis of the EU is precisely a crisis over whether a truly European state should be created, where the national states would function more like states in the United States, with more restricted sovereignty with respect to some issues, or whether the kind of muddle through strategies of the present form can continue. Many people feel that this is not a stable equilibrium, that there's no way of restoring the EU of 10 years ago, and that either they have to ratchet it up or it's going to disintegrate. And we'll see if that's the case. Whether or not in the globalization context there's even a remote prospect of creating global public institutions capable of regulating the capitalist economy on a global scale needed to create stable global conditions for accumulation, I think it's pretty far-fetched that those global institutions will emerge with enough strength to accomplish the job. We have partial forms. We do have the WTO, which does regulate trade to a certain extent. But even these partial forms are pretty ineffective with respect to creating and recreating the conditions for stable global accumulation. And this, some people argue, is a kind of Achilles heel, that capitalism will not have a robust, sustained period of accumulation into the future because it doesn't have a capacity to generate the necessary institutions to provide for that. And that's the end of my story about contradictory, contested, contingent functionality of the state and accumulation. And I think we'll actually have time to do the state and the working class because that's a compact story with a nice punchline. Let's take our break and reconvene, let's say at 10:15, 10 minutes.